Well, good afternoon, Juneau. We're about 5 seconds before 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. We're just about to start Juneau Afternoon. Pat Moore, your host today. We'll have a couple of folks here from Juneau Lyric Opera's production of Hairspray in conjunction with the high school. News intern Kelsey Gabrowski will be with us, and we'll hear from her about password protection. Suzanne and Sandy Williams will tell us a little bit more about composting in our sustainability segment. And Riverbend Elementary's principal, Shannon Avenson, will join us to tell us about two programs that are going on there. The weather looks like it's going to stay sunny all the way through, probably about Wednesday afternoon, Wednesday evening. Then it's going to start clouding up. And when it clouds up, then by Friday, it'll actually start snowing and raining. So brace yourself. We'll turn now to our two first guests and pick up the AFN update in a few moments. Joining me right now are the two folks who are director and co-producer of Hairspray, a rather unique production for Juneau because it combines the forces of the Juneau Lyric Opera with the forces of Juneau Douglas High School. Welcome. I have with me Hal Ryder, the director, and John Clough.
Cloud is the
co-producer. Yes. So we were talking beforehand. John, what's a co-producer?
Well, co-producer really just means that there's so much work to produce this show that it requires two producers, and that's not really a surprise in this case because, as we're sort of fond of saying for this show, Hairspray is the biggest, baddest, and boldest musical ever put forth by Juneau Lyric Opera, and it's such a big show and such a fun show with so many elements that we could not have done it on our own, and we are very fortunate that Michelle Amore and the people at Juneau Douglas High School have collaborated with on this. So this is their fall show for the high school and also our big production of the year for Juneau Lyric Opera, and we're really excited to be collaborating with the high school to bring this to Juneau.
Well, this is quite a unique undertaking because of the fact that you've got an almost, we can call them semi-professional, the JLO, and a high school cast that has some power behind it as well because we've had such wonderful dramatic instruction at the high school over the last several years. So you really had a base to begin with.
Well, we had a base to begin with, and of course it's been a challenge for our director, Hal, here. And what we've done is we've really tried to reach out to a lot of different parts of the community that Juneau Lyric Opera hasn't ordinarily had at its productions. Not only, of course, do we have the folks from Juneau Douglas High, but, for example, one of our leads is from Thunder Mountain High. We've got some Thunder Mountain people in the chorus. Our assistant stage manager is from Thunder Mountain. We've got a whole lot of new adults, too, in our cast that have never appeared in a Juneau Lyric Opera production before. And we're really excited. And it's been a challenge and also, I think, hopefully, a joy for our director, Hal Ryder, here to try and pull this all together on stage for us.
Well, Hal, you kind of came up from outside to lead a gaggle of folks that you hadn't had experience with before. Well, of course, I guess you have kind of.
I did. I was up here to do the Mikado for JLO a few years ago and had a wonderful experience with that. And I think we did a pretty good production that people enjoyed of Mikado. And we discussed coming up and doing another show, and it ended up to be Hairspray, which includes a lot of diversity, and that was something that I'm proud of. We're bringing lots of wonderful talent to this stage, so I'm very happy about the cast of just about 40 people.
When you have a cast of 40 people in a musical like this, the direction becomes a little more like crowd control than anything else. How many of them are you working with in a group at a time?
Well, so certainly the finale and a few other numbers have large numbers on that, and you're quite right. It's traffic cop stuff. But I also am working with two wonderful choreographers, Becky Engstrom and Janice Hurley, from Juneau here, and there's so many numbers. One choreographer wasn't enough. We had to have two, so that I'm not alone in that crowd control.
Well, that's good. It sounds like you've got a situation on your hands at any time. How many performances are we going to see?
Well, we're going to have six total performances, and we're going to open on Friday, November 2nd at the high school. All the shows are going to be at the high school auditorium, so we're going to go Friday, Saturday, Sunday on November 2nd, 3rd, and 4th, and then the following Friday, Saturday, Sunday, November 9th, 10th, and 11th. And course, we got tickets on sale already at the JunoOpera.org site, or you can go to the Jack site or stop by the Jack, or go to Rainier Tree Books or Hearthside Books. And we're really thinking we're going to get some good crowds for this show. It certainly is, I think, going to be the most fun and worthwhile show we put on in Juno in a long time. And, you know, it is so big. That's why we keep having co-everything, because there's two choreographers, there's two producers, there's two music directors, and it's just because there is so much to this show, and it's going to be a blast. I think people are really going to have a great time in there.
You guys are both real close to the show, but my listeners may not be as close as you are to it. Can you give us a little history?
Well, one of the how you discovered this, it's based on a true story. Why don't you start us off here?
Yeah, John Waters, who did the original film, actually lived in Baltimore. And so he watched a dance show by Buddy Dean.
The Buddy Dean Show.
And they broadcast that local show because they wouldn't broadcast American Bandstand, because at that time American Bandstand was integrated and Baltimore would not have an integrated show on the air. And the true history doesn't end as happily as the retelling through this musical. Ultimately, the Buddy Dean Show went off the air, and the Baltimore station chose to do that rather than integrate the show. So that message in the musical is a condensation of history pushing it forward a little bit rather than following the story. But also, John Waters did that in the original 1988 film.
And those of us who can remember what the early 1960s were like, this was set in 1962, for an awful lot of the country, it was still very much a segregated society. And although this focuses on something that might seem just as small as who's going to be appearing on the local dance show, it's emblematic of what was an absolutely vital and so important issue just sweeping across the country. And this story about how young people binding together with some older people forced attention to an issue that was just crying out for attention, really by their bravery and being willing to go first and take a step forward. I, as a resident of a town that I'm very proud, as a multicultural town like Juneau, I think that message is just as important to us today in 2012 as it was to the country back in 1962 when this play is set.
And I think the Alaska Native population would certainly absolutely agree with that viewpoint. I mean, that's one of our current issues. And then another issue that is also developed kind of in Hairspray by playing with the weight situation is the business of AIDS. That's a community that's still horribly discriminated against, even though we've moved into the 21st century here.
Well,
so
the ideas of acceptance and tolerance, I hope there's something, that's a battle you never have to stop fighting. There's always another way, another step forward to take. And this is a really fun and bright and exciting way to remind us about that. Mm-hmm. And I hope it's going to touch some heartstrings along the way.
So, and for those audience members who don't know, that traditionally the lead in that is a mom, which has always been played by a man, and the daughter is generally less known to the public. So that's always been true in the history of this show. So that's part of the tradition, and we're carrying on that tradition.
Now, of course, Hairspray, the show, was a dance show, and this musical, if you like dancing, you're going to want to come see it. Juneau Lyric Opera has never done anything with as much dancing as this, and that's why we're so glad to be collaborating with JDHS on it. In fact, our own board of directors told me when Scarlett Adam and I, my co-producer, went in and said we wanted to put on Hairspray here in Juneau, they said, "You're out of your mind. It's too big a show. It's going to require too diverse a cast, and it's got too much dancing." Well, we got these two wonderful choreographers, Becky Engstrom and Janice Hurley. They've been working on the show for almost a year, and they've been working with the cast for 4 or 5 months now. And let me tell you, if you like dancing, you're going to see some things that make your eyes pop on that stage. You really will. It's just a blast.
I am continually amazed at the capacity of the Juneau arts community to field productions of this kind of magnitude. It's like somehow we are blessed by our ability to do this. Some of the things that Perseverance Theater undertakes are scary. that they would have the guts to undertake a world premiere of something, and then they do such a tremendous job of it.
And it's not just that we have a town that is so full of so many diversely talented people with so much ability, but we have a town full of people that are willing to devote their time to a production like this. For members of this cast or for members of the crew, they have put so many, at this point, hundreds of hours into this. You know, most of the people aren't getting paid anything at all for it. They're doing it for the love of the experience and for also the love of the message that we're trying to tell. And I'm just so proud to be in a community that has people that are like that, willing to step up and just devote so much of their time and their ability just to bring the show to our town.
Hal, there's another show here completely, but let me ask one question, and that is, from your outside perspective, are we blowing ourselves up here, or is what we're thinking really true?
I've always been impressed by Juneau's arts community. I think it's a treasure here, and it's wonderful. You know, I would say you need a community auditorium or theater as well, because there are so many things. I mean, the fact that there are two major musicals going on within the next month says something. The fact that you have two opera companies, that you have a symphony, that's amazing. There are larger cities in the U.S. that don't have anything as rich, plus all the visual arts. You know, this is a very, very rich and enviously so community.
John, one last time, the air times or the show times?
We open on Friday, November 2nd at 6:30, and then we have a show at 7 o'clock on Saturday, November 3rd, 2 p.m. matinee on Sunday the 4th, then also three shows the following weekend on Friday the 9th, Saturday the 10th, and Sunday the 11th.
Go ahead, Hal.
I just want to remind, we've talked about message. This is a musical comedy.
Okay.
It's fun!
So here's a song from it.
One day my grandma, who was big and stout, she said, "You gotta love yourself from inside out." And just as soon as I learned how to strut my funky stuff, I found out that the world at large can't get enough. So bring on that pecan pie, toss some sugar on it, sugar, don't be shy. Scoop me up a mess of that. Tomorrow, side by side, we'll show them.
Great Blonde and Beautiful from Hairspray. It'll be coming the first two weekends of November. A big collaboration between Juneau Lyric Opera and the Juneau Douglas High School Theater Department. We weren't able to air National Native News right at the beginning of the show, so here comes National Native News, and stay tuned with us. We still have three wonderful guests. Kelsey Gabrowski, Suzanne and Sandy Williams will join us, and Shannon Evanson from Riverbend Elementary.
Native Voice 1. The Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Tristan Ottone, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. A new report from the National Congress of American Indians has identified a number of states where voter ID laws could have a heightened impact on Native voter access. In Alaska, Florida, and Minnesota, tribal ID cannot be used to vote. In Michigan and South Dakota, photo ID is required. And in Wisconsin, a photo ID law has been proposed for after this year's election. As well, NCAI says they're stepping up protection monitoring of Native voters in Arizona, Montana, New Mexico, and Oklahoma. NCAI President Jefferson Keel says the ongoing focus, protection, and outreach to Native voters is aimed at encouraging voters to get to the polls while making this year the largest turnout of Native voters in history.
One of the things that we've noted in 2008, there were over 1 million Native Americans who were not registered to vote. That is significant in many areas of the country where some of these races would hinge on the Native American votes.
Peter Morris is also with NCAI, working specifically with Native vote outreach and research.
If you look at what's going to decide control of the Senate, there are 8 U.S. Senate seats, and 6 of them are Native vote-focused states, from Arizona and New Mexico to Massachusetts, Wisconsin, Montana, and North Dakota. Those are 6 states that are going to decide who controls the U.S. Senate and decide who's going to be making the decisions with regard to the sequestration and the fiscal cliff in the next Congress.
NCAI has estimated that of 3 million eligible Native voters, only 2/3 are actually registered, and that of those registered, around 60% actually cast votes, making the Native vote bloc about half as strong as its potential power. NCAI officials project that voter ID laws could add additional barriers to getting Native people registered and to the polls. The Bureau of Justice Statistics recently released a report summarizing tribal crime data from reservations nationwide. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhorov reports.
The report confirms that Indian country tends to be more violent than non-tribal land, but also said that the number of Indian country suspects investigated by U.S. attorneys for violence declined 3% between 2000 and 2010. Because of its violence, Wind River Reservation in central Wyoming was chosen as a participant of High Priority Performance Goal, or the Surge as it came to be known, a federal program that gave funding to add law enforcement officers on reservations. Assistant U.S. Attorney Carrie Jacobson says that on Wind River, violence, at least in its extremes, has gone down too.
We did consider the surge extremely successful in the sense that the cases that were referred to us were of lower level, meaning people weren't hurt as bad or we had fewer people being killed. And our theory was that because there were so many officers, they were jumping on situations and were able to stop crime almost before it occurred. So the tribal prosecutor's caseload went way up. There were many more misdemeanors, but fewer felonies.
The Department of Justice has reported that, in fact, violence went up by 7% during the surge. But Jacobson says that's because incidents were reported more often. In addition to surge funds, Wind River has received almost $76,000 in grants from the Bureau of Justice Assistance between 2009 and 2011 to fund law enforcement activities. For National Native News, I'm Irina Zhorov.
On this day in 1823, Creek Chief William McIntosh attempted to bribe Cherokee leaders with $12,000 in hopes of convincing them to cede lands to the United States. McIntosh was representing the United States Indian Commissioners. The Cherokee, however, refused the bribe. This is National Native News. I'm Tristan Ottone.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation, and by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's about 21 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News. We're in the middle of Juneau afternoon. Pat Moore, your host today, and my next guest is sort of a familiar face to us around KTOO now. Our latest intern is here with us. Kelsey Gabrowski has joined us from, well, by way of Anchorage, but from Fairbanks, where she just finished some work on her degree. Welcome, Kelsey.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So what made you decide to come to Juneau?
Well, I was interested in radio in Southeast for a little while now, and my background in journalism is in print, and I wanted to get some more radio experience because it's what I want to go into, and so I was looking around for places to intern, and K2 had an opening.
Oh, outstanding. So you just packed up and moved down here.
Yeah, just a week ago.
The freedom of youth. That's wonderful. So you got a degree at UAF?
Yeah, in May I graduated with a degree in natural resource management and then also minors in journalism and Russian.
So did you do a little radio volunteering up there?
Yeah, I volunteered at KUAC and I also interned at the college radio station's technology show, General Protection Fall.
Yeah. KUAC is the National Public Radio affiliate, also PBS affiliate in Fairbanks. I think they have Channel 10 television. And the FM station.
Mm-hmm.
Do they have a campus station as well?
Yeah, that's KSUA.
Yeah, it's closed. Is that Carrier Current?
Pardon?
I think it's Carrier Current. I think it only broadcasts on the campus, right?
It broadcasts around town.
Okay, so it's about a 10-wire. Okay, mm-hmm. Anyway, interesting thing. The campus radio stations, they're sort of one of the exciting places that you can do strange broadcasting and no one really minds the odd things that you do.
Yeah.
So you were doing technology kind of specialties. Is that something you're interested in?
Yeah, but I'm really interested in science, and I was looking for experience working with the software of radio production, which I didn't have very much background in, and a close friend of mine who hosts the show offered to let me work with him.
What kinds of things have you done since you've come into this? Just I know you've only been here like a week or so, but what kinds of things do they have you doing here?
Well, yesterday my first story went up on the web. I didn't read it, but I wrote it, and that was about the salmon at Ott Creek. And then I've just been going around town gathering information for other stories.
So you're working with the news department at KTOO primarily?
Yes, and I think I'll be doing some hosting every now and then of things like All Things Considered when there's space.
Okay, I think people don't, I'm not sure people fully understand why we need a host for All Things Considered, but it's because the show comes to us in segments and we need someone to bring us the local news and to kind of fill little moments when they release the broadcast to us.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. So did you do that kind of thing at KUAC as well?
Yes, I did that in the evenings every other Friday throughout the summer, so I have a little bit of experience in it.
It's interesting. I don't know how many people know, but Alaska was the very first place that was able to receive part of its broadcast day by satellite.
Oh, wow.
This happened back in the 1970s, and it happened when I happened to be working at KUAC in Fairbanks at the time, and we got partial use of a satellite for about 6 months that was on its way to become part of the India literacy project. And they wanted to test it before they basically turned the antennas and aimed the satellite so that India could use it. And so during that time, we received All Things Considered by satellite. It was quite a moment for us because almost all broadcast news in the state of Alaska before that came by telephone line or by delay. And so to have live news as it was being broadcast off the East Coast in the United States was quite interesting for us. The program aired at 5 o'clock at night and was live at the time. So the kinds of things that we totally take for granted now in broadcasting were back then were kind of a new deal for everybody involved. So you're joining an interesting thing. Well, you've prepared a story for us, and we have it here, a pre-recorded piece on password protection. So thank you, Kelsey, for joining us, and we welcome you to the station. Let's take a look at this. Internet users should choose passwords as hackers get better at breaking into accounts. And our intern, Kelsey Kabrowski, checks up on how people in Fairbanks keep their accounts secure, and she decodes for us how easily hackers crack the average password. This story originally debuted on KSUA's computer talk show, General Protection Fault. Here we go.
As usernames and passwords increasingly overwhelm our everyday lives, hackers get harder and harder to outrace with clever word and symbol combinations. Social media alone overwhelms us with passwords to remember. There's Facebook, Pinterest, Instagram, Twitter, Foursquare, Delicious, and LinkedIn, not to mention daily necessities like email and music apps. So, how are we supposed to keep track of them all? I step outside the Wood Center at the University of Alaska Fairbanks to find out how people make their passwords easy to remember, yet hard to guess, and how much that matters to them. 23-year-old rural community development student Alan Obermiller mixes things up by using capital letters and numbers.
I either remember them or use the save passwords on my computer.
18-year-old Jessica Olson just arrived at UAF.
I remember them because I use the same one for every single thing.
Next, I go to College Corner at the bottom of Alumni Drive. I run into construction worker Shay Atlin, who's 21.
How do you remember passwords?
I make them super vulgar.
Do you do anything to make sure that's hard for other people to guess your passwords?
Yes. Well, I use swear words.
Minor Joshua Mesh isn't too concerned about making sure his password is secure, he said.
I'm not Department of Defense or anything like that, so the worst thing they could do is, you know, break in and find out an email from my mom asking me how I'm doing.
But sometimes websites ask you to make passwords that are more difficult than, say, your birthday. I decide to figure out what it takes to get a new Twitter account. Okay, I'm on the Twitter Create an Account page. I got my name all picked out and got my email. So now all I have left is my password. It says the password has to be at least 6 characters. I guess my original plan pass isn't going to work. So we'll see if password works. All one word. It says it could be more secure. Well, let's see here. I'm going to add 1989. Now it's just okay. Well, I'm going to make the P in password capital. So we got password 1989 and still okay. Let's add some flavor and add an exclamation point. Sweet, it's perfect. Cool, I'm ready to go onward into the Twitterverse. I can click create my account, and that could be the last time I worry about the security of my account, but that could be harmful for me in the long run. You see, I'm playing a game of cat and mouse with Twitter's security measures, but not with the real threat. Hackers. Now here's some background on hacking. Nowadays, if I forget to log out of Facebook and my friend posts disparaging remarks while masquerading as me, I might say I was hacked. That's not hacking. That's just being opportunistic. Hacking takes a little more skill, though now it's easier, cheaper, and faster than ever to get someone's password. On August 20th, tech blog Ars Technica pointed out the stark contrast in how we secure our accounts and, well, what's actually secure. It's tough to keep up with the demand. According to a 2007 study by Microsoft, the average American has 25 online accounts, but only uses 6.5 passwords to access them. Reusing passwords means if hackers can crack one code, they have access not only to your Twitter feed, but also to Facebook, Gmail, and Amazon. I've always tried to combat this by using passwords that are hard to guess in the first place. But according to Ars Technica, it doesn't take much computing power these days to guess every possible combination of an 8-character password. That combined with dictionaries of common words makes it pretty tough to get by with even a clever password that's less than 10 characters. The encryption code that databases use to store users' passwords can be pretty easy to crack, depending on the system. What makes the encrypted password, known as a hash, hard to distinguish is a short string of characters known as salt. And not every company goes the extra mile to add salt to their encryption. So those tricks like special characters and numbers aren't going to help you for much longer. Sentences are the way to thwart the average hacker, but that's today. Someday we might all just have to keep an encrypted file with incomprehensible strings of numbers and letters, which we'll access with a password.
An interesting piece on password protection by our newest intern, Kelsey Gabrowski, here at KTOO. It's time for Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. Author Barry Lopez takes us into the mind of Julio Sangramano, a fictional character in a short story entitled Emery Barehands Birds. The story takes place at the federal prison in Estamos, California. In it, a Native American named Emery Barehands is teaching others about the ways of animals. Julio says, "In the beginning, I didn't listen. Wild animals had nothing to do with my life. Animals were dying all over the place, sure, and for no good reason, but people were also dying the same. I was going with the people. Things, though, started working on my mind. One thing that drew me to Emery was what he said about totem animals. Every person, he told us, had an animal companion, a sort of guardian. Even if you never noticed it, the animal knew. Even when you're in prison, he said, there's an animal on the outside, living in the woods somewhere, who knows about you, and who will answer your prayers and come to you in a dream. But you have to make yourself worthy, he said. You have to have a door in yourself where the animal can get through, and you have to make sure that when the animal comes inside that way, in a dream, he sees something that will make him want to come back. We know nature has the power to heal and restore. How are you connected to the natural world? For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann. You can find a link to Barry Lopez's story on our website, birdnote.org.
Minutes before 3 o'clock, you're in tune with KTOO News.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 23rd of October, 2012. It's the birthday of the poet Robert Bridges, born Wilmer, England, 1844. Wanted to be a poet, decided the sensible thing to do is to become a doctor, work at that, retire at the age of 40. Instead, he got to retire early at 37. He got pneumonia, got a lung disorder. So he moved with his mother to a village in the Berkshires, met and married a woman named Monica Waterhouse, began to publish poems, and in 1929 he published The Testament of Beauty. It was very popular, sold tens of thousands of copies. He died 6 months later. Robert Bridges, who wrote, "I love all beauteous things, I seek and adore them. God hath no better praise, and man in his hasty days is honored for them." It's the birthday of another doctor, writer, Michael Crichton, born Chicago, 1942, author of many books, including The Andromeda Strain and Jurassic Park. It's the birthday of the director Ang Lee, born in Taiwan, 1954. His father was the principal of one of the best high schools in Taiwan, believed in traditional education, the classics, but his son went to a three-year art college, wanted to be an artist, came to the University of Illinois to study theater. He still wasn't that fluent in English, so he applied for grad school in film. He thought the language barrier would be less intense in film than in theater. Moved back to Taiwan, made his first movies there. His first Hollywood movie was his fourth one, an adaptation of Jane Austen's Sense and Sensibility in 1995. He's since made Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, Brokeback Mountain, and his newest film, Life of Pi, will be released next month. And it's the birthday of the satirist Alfred Matthew Yankovic, better known as Weird Al Yankovic, Downey, California, 1959. He's written parodies of many hit singles, such as Madonna's Like a Virgin, which he turned into Like a Surgeon, with the lines, I was last in my class, barely passed at the Institute, now I'm trying to avoid, yeah, I'm trying to avoid a malpractice suit. And he wrote a parody of Don McLean's American Pie about Star Wars, the chorus, my, my, this here Anakin guy may be Vader someday later, now he's just a small fry. And he left his home and kissed his mommy goodbye, saying, soon I'm going to be a Jedi, soon I'm going to be a Jedi. Here's a poem for today by Jessica Greenbaum, Little White Truck. Because the white truck traveling the span of the Williamsburg Bridge could be the white fastener traveling the top of a Ziploc bag, the East River and tugs might be contained without spilling in today's October light, along with this new spray of trees and picnic tables which appeared when the industrial tide of Williamsburg went out. If these could be contained, then likewise the two cyclists now dismounted and steadying their bikes as they kiss. And surely it could hold the music they heard last night eddying again around their thoughts and the memory of their first idea of the future loosed when he held her in a doorway lit by cobwebs of spring rain. Little White Truck by Jessica Greenbaum from The Two Yvonnes, poems published by Princeton University Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by Reputation.com, a service for managing businesses' online image by working to improve how they look in search engines and review sites. Reputation.com. Written by Betsy Alistair, produced by Nick Vetter. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's 22 minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau. This is Juneau Afternoon. Well, the music tells you that we're talking about sustainability again. We've been doing a series of shows through the month of October. We'll be continuing this next month as well, talking a little bit about energy after we finish our kind of mini-series on composting. We heard an excellent introduction to composting last week with Pat Harris. This week we travel to Douglas, a long trip, we find ourselves standing in front of three bins that measure about 4 feet by 4 feet, made out of plywood, that are down in the backyard garden of Suzanne and Sandy Williams. So let's hear about their composting operation.
This is what we call the coal compost method. And you'll notice we have perforated PVC pipe, which is 4-inch diameter, going through the center of each one to get oxygen down. And we learned that from the editor of Organic Gardening when he came up years ago and talked about composting. And some of us asked why our compost wasn't working well, and he said, you need to get oxygen into the mass. And so he said PVC pipe, and Sandy went out and got PVC pipe and cut it into lengths. And we do a 3-year method. This is last year's compost, and you'll see that it's gone down considerably. And we just put garbage bags or excess of black plastic over it. And that's what it looks like when it's 2 years old.
Mm-hmm. Well, this almost looks like garden soil.
It's almost there, but not quite. Mm-hmm. Not quite. And last year, and this is this year's over here. And it isn't quite finished, almost. I got to put this big board back. The reason we put boards on is because we have taco winds here, and they tend to blow the plastic off our bed, so we weight them down with rocks or boards. And this mess here is this year's compost. And you can see we've got all our garden vegetables and flowers in here.
I'll top this off with some dirt.
You'll put dirt on it to end it up. Okay. And then we'll cover it up and weight it down again for the winter. Now, each time I work in the garden or add to it, I'll come down and I'll take the plastic covers off the current year's compost bin, and I'll go out and I'll work in the garden weeding and so forth. And then I add to it, and then I cover it up when I'm done. We also put leaves, and as you can see in the back, we've got some leaves from our cottonwood tree that we rake up. Those are chopped up along with the lawn clippings, and they all go into the bin. And what are you going to do, Beer?
I'm just going to open it up a little bit.
Open it up so you can see how far down it goes. See, and that's the grass clippings mixed with leaves. Not real heavy because grass clippings take longer to break down because they get such a heavy mass, really dense, that the oxygen doesn't get at it and it doesn't break down as quickly. So we try to do the grass in thin layers. Now, this bin over here, which you see is very low, we're about to sieve this fall if we have time, and you'll notice it pretty much looks like dirt.
So when you say sift,
well, in back of you,
uh-huh.
You see we have a wheelbarrow, and we have this frame that Sandy made, and he put this steel mesh over it, nailed down. This is probably 10 years old. It's getting kind of battered. We put that over the wheelbarrow, and then we put shovel loads of compost on top of the mesh, and then I rub it with a shovel. And if it's really wet, I will use fisherman's rubber gloves, and I'll rub it, and it will go through. And
pretty good looking topsoil.
Yeah, it is good. So it'll go through fairly quick. The only thing it'll sift out, it will be the rocks or big pieces of bark that we've accidentally or inadvertently put through in. But
we don't touch it. We don't turn it. We don't do anything to it. It just sits there for 2 years and all of a sudden it stops well.
It's because we're older. Now, there are other methods that you can compost. You can use a compost if you're young and energetic. In fact, there's some people out in North Douglas and over in Gus Davis. They're younger, they got a lot of energy, and they got space. See, we don't have much space here. That they will get there and they'll flip them and turn them, and they can get compost within a year. But I'm too old. I got other things to do in my life to sit around and play with a compost pile. I'd rather look at the flowers or read a book or sit in my swing up front. But
when Sandy brought up that scoop from the older bed here, he was pointing down and there were a lot of worms in the scoop that he brought up.
I love those worms. The worms are wonderful. In fact, if we just want to keep those worms working.
Now, do you have to put like a culture in or anything, or
no.
Do the worms just come naturally?
They just come. They're part of nature, and that's okay. I love them better than I do slugs. And we want them because they work the pile, and they turn it into soil. And these are not red wigglers, commercial ones you buy. These are just part of Alaskan worms, and that's what we want. And they do a good job on the pile.
Well, it is pretty good topsoil.
Yeah, it is.
We've been standing in front of your compost piles now for about 4 or 5 minutes, and mm-hmm. I've noticed there's no smell.
No, there isn't. And that's because we keep it tightly covered, and also we layer it, I think is one reason. Very rare do I have smell. I don't know, all these years I've been doing it. If we do a layer of brown, which is leaves, and we also use, you know, kitchen scraps and garden scraps, and as long as we keep doing the layers, we don't seem to get much of a smell. I'm very careful not to use any fish scraps, shrimp or seafood or anything like that. One thing we need to remember is no citrus at all in your compost pile because Alaskan bears like citrus. That includes the grapefruit, the oranges, and the limes, and the lemons.
So have you had any problems with animals getting into it?
I had maybe 5 years ago, I had a family of squirrels over the winter nestled in the back of one. But they were basically in my garden shed and running back and forth. But that's the only problem I've ever had. I have had some bumblebees live in the back of one, but they were slow and sluggish, and they didn't seem to bother me much. So,
If someone were thinking of starting a composting operation, how much space do they need? In other words, what would you say to them?
Well, Sandy, these originally were pallets, and Sandy designed it to be pallet width. So this is
we had pallets standing up here vertical for three sides. And then strapped them together, and then just put some boards in the front to keep the where I'm working. And then when those finally went by the wayside, I think we'd had them about 10 years. Mm-hmm. I decided, well, I'll build something a little more permanent. And so basically, it's three-quarter inch or half-inch plywood, maybe 3/8 plywood. Box with 4x4 corners, posts in the ground. This is actually a little larger than most folks would want for a garden at home. Probably 3x3 mm-hmm. would be three boxes or three holes, 3x3. And that would probably be plenty. We're starting to get to the point that we don't need as much as we've composted, primarily because our beds are pretty full. And what we do in the spring, when we are starting the garden, we will layer the stuff that we have sifted out here on top of our beds. It gives them a new life. But our beds are pretty full now, so I'm not sure we're going to put all of this in the future.
Oh, but you use it in the greenhouse, yeah. In the bins. We changed it out with that. And, you know, the soil does compact over time. And the neat thing about compost is it adds loft to your soil plus nutrients. And I use about 3 5-gallon pails, and our beds are pretty much 10 by 4 feet, and I'll use at least minimum of 3 pails. The vegetable beds get the compost first, then I'll do the flower beds and the trees around our property. But the vegetable beds and the greenhouse get the compost first because they're the most important to us.
Is there any possibility of like a community composting system that would, could you envision that for Douglas or for Juneau?
That's pretty tough. You have to have it controlled. The community garden has tried it with composting, and it hasn't been really successful, mainly because you have to stay on top of it. You got to have somebody to do the green layer, the brown layer, to aerate it, and make sure the right things, components go into it. Many communities have done it, like Gus Davis, but then it's controlled by the garbage dump or your garbage service, and they control it. You bring the stuff to the dump, and then they distribute it right and get it aerated. And in turn, you get to take compost if you are home, if you are user of the garbage service, which I think is excellent. I've seen it in Bend, Oregon, which is a huge situation, which they use massive big equipment, and they have whole rolls of big material. They'll even break down untreated wood, which is just amazing. So Juneau could do it if it was part of, say, the recycling service on a whole, which I think would be wonderful.
But administration is really the problem.
It is yeah, that's the problem. You have to have it controlled and monitored, and you have to have a place for it.
Well, Suzanne and Sandy, thank you so much for the tour. We really appreciate it, and maybe we've encouraged some folks to look into composting on their own.
Well, it can be done, but you need to know what your property is, because if it's right next to your neighbor and it's very visible, then you've got to go to pretty commercial bins that you can buy at the hardware stores. Ours is out of sight and out of the way, so it doesn't have to look pretty, so that's part of it.
Thank you. Next Tuesday, we'll be talking to members of the Montessori class in the Montessori Junior High School here in Juneau Middle School, and they're composting at the school. And we'll also have Darren Snyder from the Cooperative Extension Service talking about getting that program started, as well as composting, which he does in his office. So sustainability, it's an ongoing project here in Juneau. And we have a couple of people who are in ongoing projects at Riverbend Elementary School. The principal, Shannon Avinson, is with us here, and Karen Doxey, one of the teachers. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. So what's going on at Riverbend?
Well, we are pretty excited about some major academic gains that we've made in the last school year. And last year we had Karen Doxey on the show talking about PBIS. Karen, if you want to explain a little bit about PBIS.
We're in our fifth year of initiative, I guess, where we teach students how to be successful in an academic setting. And we tell them exactly when they are being successful. So in other words, we're reinforcing for them that thing that you're doing right there is that's a successful behavior. Good job. Thank you. Keep it up. And we do that in several different ways. We're in our fifth year, and we've noticed a huge difference in our building just in the way it looks and sounds. But the way it's related to the academic gains is really simple. If kids are in class and paying attention, their chances of learning are greater. And I think with PBIS, we've just really made it evident that when you're in class and you're learning, that's what we want and that's what you're going to be rewarded for. So it's been very successful.
This is, we had talked beforehand about the importance of this kind, these kinds of programs in the students' future. In the sense that once you implant these ideas now, then they take them forward, and it makes them better students in the succeeding years, as well as getting some control and order in your own classroom. It moves it forward. To what extent is there follow-up? I know AVID is throughout the whole system now, and it's mm-hmm. in the high schools, and I think in most of the middle schools. So but as a student comes out of your AVID program, do they slide into the next level when they move on? Is that part of the structure?
Well, right now, that's a really good question. Riverbend is piloting the AVID program, or the first elementary school to implement it here. And what we're doing at the elementary level is it's classroom-wide. So we've had two teachers that have been trained, one fourth-grade teacher and then Ms. Doxey here in the fifth grade. And in those classrooms, every student in those classrooms they're all getting AVID strategies, and Karen can talk about that a little bit. But as they go to middle school, what will happen is they go with those skills, obviously, that they've learned in fourth and fifth grade at Riverbend. However, I know at the middle schools right now, they are elective classes, so students are selected. So that's something that's, you know, some parents are asking those questions at this time. How can we make sure that this transitions into success in middle school as well?
And what we're focusing on at the elementary level, really what it boils down to is how to organize yourself to get your stuff home, get your homework done, and get it back. And honestly, even if they don't go into an AVID program in middle school, still what they're learning is going to help them be successful in any class that they have. So I think that officially, they may not go into an AVID classroom, but definitely what we're teaching them is going to help them be successful in that environment.
I think that there may be a tendency, particularly among educated parents, to think that students don't have to have these skills so much taught to them as it's something that they know how to do.
I think that's,
do you find that
such,
true?
That's such a good way of looking at it, because really the AVID skills, and I can say this because I have a son, who was really, really bright, but was in danger of failing classes because he didn't get his homework turned in. So his ability in school had nothing to do almost with how he functioned in school. So the things that I'm teaching my fifth graders would have helped him immensely just staying organized and getting the work all the way to the teacher to get the grade. So I think that the demographic that you're talking about, the AVID strategies are maybe even more important.
I'm basing this on my own experience, because when my kids started school, I knew how to do that.
Right.
And I think my take on it a lot of times was, geez, you know, why would I have to show them how to get this work done? Because, you know, and I'm kind of clueless as to why they don't sometimes, or why they didn't sometimes. They're older now, both of them, out of school successfully, but despite my best efforts. So how much involvement is there for the parent in these two programs?
The parents of AVID students in the programs, we're asking them to attend a couple of informational meetings so that they can understand the overall goal of the AVID program. On a day-to-day level, their involvement is to look at the children bring home an agenda planner that has their homework. We're asking the parents to look to see if they did their homework and initial the agenda planner and send it back so that, there's a constant communication between home and school.
And I'm actually, in addition to being the principal, I have a son who's in fourth grade in one of the AVID classrooms, and it's just been a wonderful experience for my husband and I. We're just constantly reminding each other, did you check his homework? Did you sign off? And he's learning. He's a bright kid, you know, like Karen was talking about her own son, bright kid, but as far as organization goes, you know, he struggles. And so it's been a good tool.
Are there kids that are somehow gifted with the ability to organize themselves, or is this something that every child really needs to be taught?
It's a rare. You have those kids who enjoy being organized,
yeah.
But even and I was one of those kids who really enjoyed being organized. However, you know, I was never shown how to take notes, and so that's something that when we went to the AVID training, it was kind of interesting to see how many professionals, how many educators were in the room that had never been taught how to take notes. And so, you know, there's some of those simple strategies that you think, wow, if I would have been taught this in middle school or elementary, I could have been, you know, it could have been pretty helpful.
I have two students in my class who have really taken to it, but they both have older siblings, so I couldn't tell you if it was natural or learned.
Well, two programs. AVID is being piloted at River Bend, and the Positive Behavioral Interventions and Support, or PBIS, is also a school-wide program tied together and improving our students' ability to organize themselves. Thank you so much for updating us on happenings in the school system. Want to tune in to Juno Afternoon tomorrow. Andy Klein will be hosting, and he's going to talk with Stacy Polson about things that are going on at Nugget Mall for Halloween. There's a potluck tomorrow night at TMHS for exchange students. His guest Sue Baxter will fill you in on that. Erica Lee will come in to highlight the Kids Time Arts Academy. And Aaron Elmore from Theater in the Rough will be here with news because they are producing Macbeth. So if you want to learn all about Scottish kings, this is the answer. You are in tune with KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We also broadcast on these translators in the Valley and Auk Bay. You can tune to K276 AF. That's 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, we're on K269 AO. That's 101.7 megahertz. Gustavus listens on K21 AM. That's 88.1. K220BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can hear KTOO on K210 AS. They broadcast on 89.9 megahertz. In Juneau, you can also get KTOO on GCI Cable Juneau. We're on digital channel 871. Our sister stations, KRNN and KXLL, are on 872 and 873. And we stream continuously online at www.ktoo.org. Update on the weather forecast, partly cloudy for the rest of tonight, lows 31 to 38, southeast winds 15 to 25 miles per hour, the gusts are 45 downtown, and we should have the strongest winds near downtown Juneau and, of course, out on Douglas. Wednesday, partly cloudy, highs around 42, southeast winds 15 to 25 miles per hour, gusting up to 45, and the strongest winds again, downtown Juneau and Douglas.